Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
Coming up on Heard on the Street, why is Goldman Sachs getting mixed up in Venezuelan debt? And how Trump's policies may be affecting U.S. tourism.
Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Hello and welcome to Heard on the Street, the podcast. We are the Wall Street Journal's home for commentary on all things financial all over the world. Reporting from New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried, joined by my colleague Alex Frangos in London. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Miriam.
So in our second segment, we'll talk about some early signs that tourism to the U.S. may be falling after the election of President Donald Trump. But first, we have Heard on the Street's Anjani Trivedi on the line from Hong Kong to talk to us about Goldman Sachs' misadventure in Venezuelan bonds. Hi, Anjani.
Hi, Miriam.
So, Anjani, the unpopularity of the Venezuelan government has been clear for quite a while, and it's been accused of causing a humanitarian crisis in that country. Yet Goldman Sachs decided to buy $2.8 billion worth of Venezuelan bonds. And now they've been accused of propping up this government. So why would Goldman want to wade into this kind of a quagmire?
Well, look, first of all, we have to remember that, you know, Goldman Sachs is not the only one and has not been the only one either. For, you know, as long as the Venezuelan government has been unpopular, there have been as many investors that have been buying these bonds, and those investors range from, you know, the PIMCOs and BlackRocks of this world to Nomura and Goldman Sachs, and even retail investors. In fact, the bonds are so widely held, companies that operate in Venezuela are often paid in PDVSA bonds. So, you know, we have to realize that these are liquid markets. There's a lot of debt out there. They're high yielding. And, you know, people do have the kind of sense that these are government backed.
So would you say it's just the name Goldman that sort of raises ire among people? Is it just seeing that name that kind of caused this to, bring headlines?
Well, no, it is. I mean, there is, you know, people do, you know, Goldman is associated with its opportunism and they are good at what they do. And there is always this kind of, they just come with, you know, its reputation for having these kind of connections precedes it. But it also has, you know, we saw in 1MDB, Goldman's been associated in that case. It's been associated with Libya. It's been associated with these cases of taking advantage of, you know, financially less savvy, you know, regimes or places in the world, or, you know, but the reality is these are emerging markets, you know, and I'm not saying that that's what they're doing in these places is right, but I'm just saying in Venezuela, you know, this is how the Venezuelan bond market works. PDVSA issues billions of dollars of bonds as they did in January. They issue it directly to the central bank. The central bank offloads it in the secondary market. PIMCO, Goldman, everyone goes and buys them. That's just how that bond market works.
But I think that one of the interesting aspects here, Anjani, you write about this in your column, is that there are a lot of these index funds that just track the whatever index, the bond index, in this case, I guess the JP Morgan Emerging Market Bond Index, and the ETFs that follow it have to own these bonds. That's in their charter. And yep. At the same time, if you're a fund manager operating a fund that tracks any of these indexes, you also kind of have to own these bonds, because if you don't and the bonds go up, then you're going to have a really poor performance. So this gets at a really interesting question to me, which is everybody gets outraged. Oh my gosh, Goldman Sachs is, you know, going and propping up this regime, which it may or may not be doing. But point is, we all own this stuff, and we all, you know, have to be comfortable with owning not just Venezuelan bonds, but Russian bonds and Turkish bonds
and Nigerian
bonds and Philippine bonds and places where regimes are doing some really awful stuff. And I think the question is, as an investor, like, where do you where's your ethical line? Are you amoral, or do you put your money where your mouth is? And I think, you know, Goldman is, you know, epitomizes this stuff, but, you know, probably all need to look in the mirror and decide, you know, where we're putting our savings.
Agreed. And I think, you know, one thing you have to remember is, you know, people have mentioned the Venezuelan bonds. Venezuela, I know Haussmann came out and, you know, said, oh, they should take them out of the index and so on. But these kind of, you know, the JP Morgan case, these are kind of, you know, there's rules and there's criteria. And so they, you know, they started phasing Nigeria out of their index because it wasn't fitting certain criteria. And so these are systems. And Venezuela actually only makes up the sovereign and quasi-sovereign 2% of the index. For all the bonds that are out there and for as liquid as they are, that's how much of the index they make up.
But it does, this index thing, I mean, that 2% or 2.4% or whatever it is of the index that's Venezuela, that provides an automatic bid for Venezuelan bonds, right?
Absolutely.
And so, just by nature, it, you know, gives support, gives the government the ability through its state-owned oil company
to finance
itself, and it is doing awful, awful things. It's letting, you know, the Wall Street Journal had this incredible story a couple weeks ago about how there's basically a famine in Venezuela, that you have the country with the biggest oil reserves in the world letting its people starve. And index funds essentially are enabling that, right?
Absolutely, which is why I think we have to put things in perspective and think like, well, yes, Goldman Sachs, you know, makes headlines, but the reality is it's, you know, everyone is holding this stuff.
So, Anjani, Goldman argued in our story that they bought the bonds because they think things have to get better, things have to change in Venezuela, and they want to be there for that change. Does that sound like a valid rationale?
I mean, look, I think, you know, the kind of, if you look at it from a purely from a financial markets perspective, people are increasingly talking about a sovereign restructuring. And that would mean that, you know, the way we've seen in Ukraine, the way we've seen in Greece, you know, these are, and what, you know, Paul Singer did, you'll see people can't come out on top of this, but a restructuring would help Venezuela get its finances in order and provide, you know, food and bring inflation under control and, you know, just have more efficient credit in the economy. And while a restructuring can take a long time, you know, I think done the right way, if there are savvy investors, then, you know, you'd hope that it would get done the best way. You know, people took a 20% haircut in Ukraine and, you know, downside scenarios on Venezuela say people could take as much as a 50% haircut, but, you know, bondholders could actually come out better than that. That's the worst case.
So I'm wondering, going back to the index fund issue, do you think that the rise of passive investing has sort of made it easier to ignore the fact that we're all propping up these regimes in some way or another?
In part, but then, you know, we're also propping up in that same vein, we're also then propping up, you know, crappy companies across the world, because a lot of these funds and, you know, insurance trusts and all the stuff they hold, you know, you look at their filings and they hold random Chinese company bonds and random Chinese company stocks. And so we're also, you know, you're just propping up a whole lot of crap,
but maybe it's only 1 or 2%.
But that's where it comes in, right? That's where you go look at, and, you know, this sounds academic, but that's where you kind of go look at your fact sheets. You go look at where you're investing and you don't look at yield, right? Like, even whether it's a retail investor or a real money investor, everyone's chasing yield. And so I'm pretty sure the guy who's investing in GSAM or who has his money in GSAM is not complaining about the, you know, 10 whatever percent they've been getting for the last few years on Venezuelan through their fund on Venezuelan bonds.
Yeah.
So people aren't complaining as long as they're getting those returns.
Sure.
But the moment that turns is, you know, you suddenly want to be on, you know, the right moral side of it. But you know, that's where I guess people need to figure out and do their work around it.
It sounds like
it's easy to blame.
Yeah, Goldman has its fiduciary duty to its investors and to its shareholders, which might sometimes get in the way of these moral questions about propping up regimes and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can look at their filings, you can look at their fact sheets, you can look at their annual reports, and they say that they hold these bonds. You know, no one's hiding that.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting we went through a period for, you know, 20 years where emerging markets like Venezuela and other places were seen not just, you know, as places to get yield and improving economies and things like that, but they were also seemed to be on a path towards, you know, political legitimacy. I mean, for Venezuela, it's been a long time, you know, since the late 90s. But, you know, we now have where most emerging markets, it's not the exception, it's really the rule, where most emerging markets have some sort of huge political, baggage in terms of their human rights or democracy or, you know, their posturing towards the U.S. And, you know, as an American investor, you have to when you buy an emerging market fund, if getting return isn't your highest priority, if it's supporting, you know, a particular way of life, then emerging markets are much more fraught than they used to be. I mean, if you look at, you know, it's China, Russia, you know, Brazil has been going through political, you know, corruption crises. I mean, wherever you go, your money is not necessarily supporting, you know, just, you know, economies that are improving and lifting people out of poverty the way maybe you thought they were 20 years ago.
That makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're going to have to take a break. Coming up, how the Trump administration's policies could be keeping tourists away from the U.S.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
Need to get your news fix? Look for WSJ on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and the Amazon Echo, The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from The Wall Street Journal.
Welcome back to Heard on the Street, the podcast. I'm Miriam Gottfried. I'm here with Alex Frangos and our colleague Justin Lehart, who joins me in the studio here in New York. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Miriam.
So, Justin, you have written about how policies put in place by President Trump have affected businesses that rely on immigrant labor to, you know, immigrants to the U.S. But now you're seeing that some Trump policies and attitudes may be affecting tourism to the U.S. What are you seeing?
Yeah. So what we're seeing right now is, you know, we know that when Mr. Trump instituted the travel ban back in January, first instituted, that there was a huge drop off in people searching for flights to the U.S. and that type of thing. What we're seeing right now is that it's starting to really show up. It's beginning to show up in the data.
Because this is sort of the summer travel season kicking off.
Right. This is, you know, it takes a few months to put your plans together. And, you know, now it's happening. We had on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve released its beige book, and there are a number of places, including New York City, that are saying, you know, we're seeing soft travel. New York City itself has said that the city's going to see 300,000 fewer people from overseas, expects 300,000 fewer people from overseas this year than last year. It's the first time there's, you know, that would mark the first decline in foreign travel to the city since the financial crisis.
Now, Justin, is this unprecedented, or was there a similar, you know, downturn, let's say, during the Iraq War when America was not perhaps the most popular country in the world?
Yeah, there was. There was. It was. It did weaken substantially during that period. And one of the things that's interesting, right, is there's this there's a Pew survey on, you know, how people view the U.S. and the contours of that, where people's view of the U.S. fell the most, was where tourism to the U.S. weakened the most. So if that's happening again, you know, then we're going to, you know, potentially see a real, you know, significant drop in tourism to the U.S.
And so who gets hit? So if I'm an investor and I'm looking at through my portfolio, I'm thinking hotels, airlines, restaurant companies, so far this year, hotels, have been doing pretty well. Stocks like Hilton and Marriott have been going up, quite a bit more than the S&P 500. So this, how big of a factor is this for them?
Yeah, I guess it's really, and this is something that Miriam can speak to a little bit more because we're working on this together. But I think, if you look at hotels, right, first thing you have to understand, they're international, right? A lot of them are really international. So, okay, so they have fewer people coming here, but maybe they have more people going to their hotel in France. So, if a more international hotel is going to be better shielded against this. Now, I think a lot of hotels, and they also say, international travel is only a small part of what we do. But, if you see a decline in travel, right, even if you don't cater to international people at all, right, there are more rooms available that people can get. There's a higher vacancy rate, and that is going to affect you.
So just to add to that, I went through a bunch of hotel conference call transcripts, and you're right, so far they haven't really said that much about this trend, but we did see Hyatt, which has a number of hotels, in the New York area and more metropolitan areas, saying that they saw a decline in inbound foreign tourism. They said that was only a small portion of their revenue, or that inbound foreign tourism is only a small portion of their revenue. But they said they saw a decline. Expedia said a slowdown in travel from the Middle East, which I guess shouldn't be surprising given the rhetoric that we've heard surrounding the proposed Muslim ban and that kind of thing. But, beyond that, I think retailers, particularly luxury retailers, could be hurt by this because a lot of foreign tourists will come to the U.S. and spend a lot of money on those kinds of things. Maybe in a broader sense, it could be ma and pa stores that are hurt too. Restaurants, not just publicly traded companies. I think also resorts, maybe Disney, Six Flags, those kinds of places, they also get a lot of tourism, and their peak season isn't till like July, August. So that's going to be a lagging indicator.
Let me ask you guys another question, which is, so much hinges on currency when it comes to people's decision making to do international travel. And, the dollar has been somewhat weaker in the first few months of the year, but all in all, the dollar is basically strong historically, especially in markets where we get most of our tourists, like Europe and Japan. In defense of Donald Trump's reputation here, is some of this maybe also just an economic decision that people are saying, look, a French person is saying, I'd love to go to, to Disneyland, but it's just too expensive because of the dollar. So I'm going to stay home and go to Euro Disney or go to Spain this year or go to the UK where the pound has fallen 15% because of Brexit.
I guess, but first thing, the currency difference from last year isn't that big. It's a little bit stronger, right? The dollar's a little bit stronger, but not a lot.
It was pretty strong last year.
Yeah, and then we're comparing to last year. And then, look, Europe's in better shape now. You're feeling better if you're in Europe now. You're feeling better if you're in Japan now, right? You're feeling better if you're a lot of places now. That gives you an impetus to travel. The other thing that's really interesting is there's some data from this company Hopper, right? Their airfare tracker. And they basically tap into these systems, the same systems that Expedia uses, right, to look, okay, who's searching on flights? What they saw during the travel ban was there's a huge drop in interest in searches for travel to the U.S., right? And this wasn't just from the banned countries. This was like across the board, right? So it was really, something happened and there was an effect.
Yeah, I think that's important. This isn't about inability to get visas. This is about sentiment. And sentiment surrounding the U.S. and how we're perceived by the rest of the world is really the biggest driver of whether tourists come to our country.
Yeah. And then the other thing I should say is, we have new data that just came out on Thursday which shows, sort of tapping into the same data that Hopper uses. Right. So Forward Keys, which is this travel consultancy, says Bookings to the U.S. are now down 3.5% versus a year ago. They're up a lot for every other place, right? Every other major destination. So it's really, really happening. And now's the time that it's going to start hitting, June, July, August.
Well, let me ask you a kind of a bigger question outside of tourism. If it's sentiment and people are really just soured on America because of the politics, because of the rhetoric, because of whatever, would this bleed into bigger business decisions? I mean, if you're a European company or a Japanese company, are people, you know, and you have a big opportunity to invest in America, are you going to, you know, not do it just simply because you don't like who's president?
I don't know about that, but I think that the reason that you might not do it right now is just that things are so unsettled, right? There's going to be, is there going to be a tax cut? Is there not going to be a tax? I mean, it's very, very hard to understand what's going on. So that kind of decision-making process, I don't know how people, I don't know how people sort of figure that out.
Well, I mean, it would seem, you know, investment decisions are much more long term than a travel decision. A travel decision is just, where am I going this summer? Next summer, I might go to the place I didn't want to go this summer because maybe things have changed. Maybe my attitude toward it has changed. Maybe even the dollar is weaker or whatever it is. But I think investment decisions are much more long term decisions. So, I mean, once people do feel like there's stability here in the U.S., they might be willing to commit. I think that would be not as dependent on a particular person being president.
I'm just interested in the thought process of the international traveler who says, you know, I want to go on vacation. Here are the 10 destinations I could go to. And, you know, here are the things I want to do. Maybe I'll go to America and see the Grand Canyon, or go to New York City, or, you know, go to Chicago. And I'm going to say, oh, I don't want to go because of the guy who's in the White House and because of what's on the TV news. Never mind that that doesn't affect any of the things that I'm going to be doing. And yet that seems to be what we're seeing. Would you guys ever, you know, kind of not do a trip because you didn't like who, you know, who was the leader in that country?
Yeah, I actually might.
I would take that into account. Sure.
I think I would. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on the Trump tourism effect.
It's like having a crystal ball inside your earbuds. The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
So, Justin, if you had to guess, which sector of the economy would you say might take, you know, the biggest hit if tourism does fall, as we're predicting here?
I'm going to guess sort of the resort area, the resorts, that kind of thing. That seems like the thing that's going to be the biggest sort of, right, things where people are coming for a long time, right? Because international tourists, they don't come for, they're not day trippers, right? And there's no sort of, it's harder to sort of fill that gap. What do you think?
I think that makes sense. I think, you know, a lot of the analysts that I've talked to so far have been focused on New York as being hit by this, which is definitely true because New York gets a ton of international travel. But I think it's important to remember that there are metropolitan areas around the U.S. that also see a lot of international travel. I mean, whether that be Orlando with Disney World or L.A. or Chicago or, you know, even resort destinations that are in more remote places, I think all of that could affect, you know, could be affected by a change in sentiment.
I would be looking at the hotel companies and the real estate, especially the real estate investment trusts that own hotels.
Yes.
In New York, Orlando, Anaheim, those areas, they're the ones who are going to feel the brunt of it.
Yes, I think that is one thing that that I've found in my research, is that the REITs that own hotels are more exposed to New York than the big hotel companies. The big hotel companies are pretty diversified. Hyatt is one that might have had more exposure, but it sort of identified, you know, what its risk was already. There are some REITs that really are very concentrated in New York, though, and I think they could feel the pain of this. So I guess we're going to end it there.
All right.
That wraps things up for this week's Heard on the Street podcast. Please join us every week for the latest in global investing. For more, please check us out at wsj.com/heard. That's wsj.com/heard. You can also email us with your comments, suggestions, or questions at heardpodcast@wsj.com. From New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried. On behalf of the rest of the Heard on the Street team, thanks for listening.
Follow the Wall Street Journal on your favorite podcast app. Search WSJ on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and any Amazon Alexa device. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.